Welcome to Rediscovering You, the podcast where we empower you to rediscover your life and manifest your dreams. I'm Laura Flowers, a transformational life coach with nearly 20 years of experience in the fields of psychology, mental health, and education. No matter where you are or what you've been through, it's never too late to reimagine your future. Whether you're ready to pivot, redefine success on your own terms, or simply take that first step towards a more fulfilling life, Rediscovering You is here to support and guide you. Each episode, we will share inspiring stories, practical tools, and powerful insights to help you break free from limiting beliefs and manifest the life you've always dreamed of. Are you ready to rewrite your story? Let's get started. Welcome to Rediscovering You, episode 32. Today's episode is an important one, but I want to begin with a content warning. We will be discussing sibling sexual abuse, or SSA, and the lasting impact of trauma. This is a sensitive topic that may be triggering for some listeners. Please take care of yourself while listening and know that you can always pause or step away if needed. If you or someone you know needs support, I will be sharing resources in the show notes. With that said, I am honored to welcome today's guest, Jane Epstein. Jane is a survivor and a fierce advocate for those who have experienced sibling sexual abuse. She is the co-founder of both Incest Aware and FiveWaves.org, an international nonprofit working to change how sibling sexual trauma is understood and addressed. You may know Jane from her powerful TEDx talk, which has over 600,000 views, or from her features in People Magazine, the Sunday Times Magazine, and Fox TV. She has also shared her story in her memoir, I Feel Real Guilty, which is now available on Amazon, Audible, and Barnes & Noble. Jane's work is breaking the silence around an issue that is often ignored, and today she is here to share her journey, her advocacy, and what we all need to understand about sibling sexual abuse. Jane, thank you so much for being here and for the work that you do. I am truly honored to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
Hoping that you can start by sharing what you're comfortable with your experiences with SSA, and at what point did you start to realize that maybe this was something that was a problem?
Sure. I was about 45, 47 years old when I had to come to terms with there was something inside of me that needed work. I had been in marriage counseling for 5 years with my now husband, and we'd made progress, but the therapist turned to me and said, Jane, your anger and depression don't match the circumstances. Is there something else we don't know about? I went home maybe a couple of days later. I'm sitting on the staircase and I'm thinking, hey, what is wrong with me? And it was at that moment that I decided that maybe there was something inside of me that needed work. So I called the therapist and I made a one-on-one appointment without my husband. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, there's this one thing that we haven't talked about. And I said, my sibling messed with me when I was little. And it was at that moment that he kind of tried to not freak me out, but he said, okay. And I said, but that's not a problem, is it? That's not why I'm depressed. That can't be it. Because I was a kid. He was a kid. I was complicit. And he said, well, no, it's actually very complicated. So I think it was at that point that I realized that, okay, no, this had a bigger impact on me than I had ever realized.
And that to me is so wild to think that it took 40 years, give or take, of living with this and this being a part of shaping you and who you are, and to not have it come to your conscious awareness that this actually had a major impact on how your life unfolded.
Right. I had been hiding and pushing it aside for 40 plus years, just thinking, well, that can't be it. That's not why I'm struggling. That's not why I'm depressed. I was in complete denial.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that it took for so long for you to be able to realize that this was having an impact? What was there, looking back in hindsight now, can you think about why you might have been pushing this down or not acknowledging it or bringing it to the forefront of your thinking?
I think that there are a couple things. First of all, the shame. The shame was a big one. Secondly, is we don't talk about sibling sexual abuse. I thought I was alone. I thought it was just something that happened to me. I thought it was an anomaly. And I spent so much time running from the shame and trying to bury it that I don't think I was present in my life for about 40 years. I think I was disassociated from me, from who I am for about 40 years, kind of just had my head in the sand and was busy running, busy chasing boys, busy drinking, busy doing drugs, all the things to not be fully known. But when the time came, and I'm not a therapist, I don't know, but these are things that I've come across and things that resonate with me. I think that I was finally in a safe place in my life, and I'd had two children by that time, which kind of triggered a lot of the memories, and the memories were not going back into the box. I was in a safe marriage and I was a safe place to start healing and to start digging and to start sharing my story. That's my belief.
And I think that sibling sexual abuse is, there's a distinction between that and between the more global term of childhood sexual abuse. And there's not a lot of information out there about this. So if you were experiencing something with a sibling, and then, living with this memory or this experience in your life, there's really like, people aren't talking about this and it's not really well known. Can you talk a little bit about what makes sibling sexual abuse different from and maybe harder to talk about and look at than the more global term of childhood sexual abuse?
Right. I think, first of all, we aren't talking about it. And as a child, when it was happening to me, we talk about, uncles or someone in the church or an older adult touching you, but we don't talk about another child touching you. And it was very confusing to me. I knew on some level it wasn't right, but I didn't understand. I didn't have the words. And no one had told me that even siblings could cause harm. So I didn't have the terminology and I didn't understand the damage until I was in my 40s. And a lot of times I've heard this as well, that children who are the person who causes harm or causes abuse, they are acting from a child's perspective and they don't understand. They know it was wrong at the time, but they don't understand the damage until they're looking at it from an adult's perspective. So I'm in this child's perspective with another child. And as you become older, you're like, okay, wait, that was wrong. But they were a kid too. And it's very confusing. And I think that society doesn't want to think about it. I'm a parent. I'm a parent of two teenagers. And the thought of one of my children harming another is really hard to wrap my head around. And it has such an ick factor. It still has an ick factor. As much as we're trying to normalize the conversation, it still repulses people.
And I think that's a really valid point that because there is the ick factor, people just choose not to talk about it. And making the choice to be silent about it can have incredibly damaging effect on survivors and also on the family system as a whole for not shining a light on this really important and much more common thing that happens. And because we are quiet about it, then when families or parents, I'm wondering, maybe you could speak about your own situation. If others in your family suspected that maybe something was happening between you and your sibling, but didn't want to go there because it was so ick or like there was so much shame, can you talk about that piece of it as well? And from other families' members maybe noticing that something isn't quite right or having a hunch, and what your experience was like, and what it could have been if it were a different experience.
That's a big question.
It is.
First of all, I think that parents, we try and do the best we can. And I want to say that it's not the parents' fault. And when we screw up as a parent, because I'm a parent, we feel horrible. And so if you have a hunch that this might be occurring in your family and you go to Google and Google's silent, then you're going to brush it under the rug. You're just going to think, well, no, we're the only people. It as a parent, and I can speak from a parent's perspective because I work with parents, it blows up the whole family. How do you choose one child over the other? And if this occurs in your family, it's not like you can share with your best friend, hey, this is happening in my family. Because in your best friend, their child might be a playmate and they're not going to let your child come over and play. There are people, because we aren't talking about it, because we don't know enough about it, your child is generally assumed to be a monster or a pedophile. And some of these children who do abuse are could be pedophiles, could be very, very dangerous people. But 95% of the children who abuse or cause harm with therapy don't go on to harm as an adult. So that's important. Or if we're not talking about it, if a parent suspects and they go to Google and there's nothing out there, they're going to push it under the rug. There's so much shame involved in it. And that in turn hurts the victim, the survivor, because if you just say, well, don't let that happen again, you're dealing with children. And in particular, in my situation, my sibling was curious and my sibling made a conscious decision to get me alone. And his body responded. And then his body wanted more. So if someone had said, don't do that again, you are dealing in my situation with a 12-year-old. And I don't know if that would have occurred. And say they said, don't do that again, I was still already harmed. I didn't understand that I was harmed, but my body at age six had been awakened to sexual feelings that I should not have had at age six. So had my family intervened, I would like to think, I would hope to think that they would have done more than just sat us down and said, don't do that. I
Is
would
that
like
what
to think
happens?
that no, they never discovered. I didn't disclose to my mother until I was about 24, and my father passed away without ever knowing. I say that with a little hesitation because I believe there was a time that he came down the hallway and heard some noise and said, what's going on in here? Opened the door and then closed it. Now, he was a school psychologist. He was very involved in other kids' lives, but not focusing on what was going on at home. Would that have changed the trajectory of my life and my siblings' life? I don't know. I know that I grew up very troubled, and I can look at that and say that what happened to me is from 6 to age 12 definitely changed my life and definitely led to some very poor life decisions. I can only speak to my sibling from hearsay, in that I don't think that there are some lasting damage from the choices he made. And I will say that I do hear from people who cause the abuse or harm, and sometimes they are suicidal because of the guilt. So it's a whole family trauma, and brushing it under the rug is not the way to go.
Not at all, not at all. And I appreciate you bringing up the perspective of the person that causes harm as well, and how that, because we have to remember we're talking about children most of the time. And so that can have a huge, long-lasting negative impact on the trajectory of their lives as well, because of the shame and the guilt and the remorse, and probably not talking about it with anybody, because why would you want to talk about that with anybody? And it's messy. This is a messy topic because, like you said earlier, it's children doing things with children a lot of the times, and so it's, your comment that you made earlier is just that, oh, like I was complicit in it and we were both kids, so I couldn't have been wrong. And so you lived that narrative, which was a false narrative, but it became your truth for so long. And you said that it impacted you and had a detrimental effect on the choices that you made growing up and in your young adult life. Can you talk a little bit about what some of the impacts were on your choices?
Sure. I am going to go back to something you said. We are talking about children, and that's what makes it so confusing. And as survivors, this is what I've experienced. My sibling didn't go on to cause harm. Other survivors, their sibling did go on to cause harm as an adult or sexually abuse. And some survivor I'm able to use caused harm, abuse. Some survivors do not like harmful sexual behavior or childhood caused harm. So I just want to put that out there that If you're the survivor, if you're the victim, only you know how you experienced it, and I want to honor that language.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. So it like you just said, it's messy, it's complicated, and the language matters, but we can't seem to agree on the language because every case is so different. The way that it impacted my life is from age 6 to 12, I was sexually abused by my sibling, and my body responded, and I enjoyed the sexual feelings. I didn't understand what they were. I was six. And as I stated earlier, I knew on some level it was wrong, but I didn't know. I didn't have the words. And then I covered it up as well. So I felt like I was complicit. And in my mind, my sibling was not a bully. My sibling did not threaten me. So it wasn't like I felt like he was physically hurting me, not knowing the mental and psychological damage down the road. So my choices when he left for college and the sexual abuse ended, I needed male attention. I needed validation. I got in trouble in on the playground for kissing a boy. I was angry. I had a temper. And I think that anger was the shame. My mom just thought that I was volatile. She just thought, well, she was going through a divorce at that time. I was being a teenager. I didn't show any outward signs of sexual abuse, in fairness to my mother. And it just kind of continued down a path of I started cutting class, I started drinking, I started doing drugs. I barely graduated from high school. And I did graduate from high school and I started a business college for about a year, but I was drawn to the stripper stage. There was something inside of me that wanted to become a stripper. I mean, I'm dating myself here, but I would circle the help wanted ads and I wanted to be a stripper. And I ended up on the stripper stage. I became a stripper. So that's kind of, that is the bulk of the trajectory of my life. And I will say that, we can talk about stripping separately, but stripping served its purpose. And I think I kind of landed in a semi-healthy situation for a period of time. But then later in life, I became depressed and the memories still, the trauma still needed to be resolved. Even though I think that the stripping was the first, it sounds kind of wild, but it was the first step towards my healing process.
It makes sense. No, it doesn't sound wild because it's almost like you are taking control of your sexuality in a way that you didn't have the autonomy that you should have at the beginning of when you started having these sexual feelings at such a young age.
Right. Yeah, and that's actually where I met my first husband. My first husband, I met him. I was on the stripper stage and we met, and I have no problem saying it was love at first sight and that he rescued me. I believe he rescued me from the stage. So I don't have any regrets about that. I'm trying to kind of make this streamlined but not rush through it and answer your questions. But this, I think this is kind of important to the healing process in that he did rescue me. We did get married and he taught me a lot of things like how to dress, how to socialize, and supported me as I got back into school. And 7 years into our marriage, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Oh my goodness.
So he passed away. But at that point, grief is a whole nother discussion. I think at that point, I had been in denial and not present in my life and disassociation that when he died, I had no choice but to feel. And I had to feel, and I felt alive probably for the first time in a very long time. And I felt joy, and I felt like I'd been gifted a gift of life and appreciation. And I thought, okay, that's my story. But my story wasn't finished. But the grief process taught me that healing isn't linear. It's not by the book.
So
So
true.
when I got remarried and the memories resurfaced, I could kind of look to that healing process of the grief and think, okay, there may not be a finish line to this healing process, and it's going to be moving, and the finish line's always constantly changing and evolving. So that's kind of what that grief process taught me. And I had slipped back into a feeling of disassociation. So that wasn't that was short-lived because, you know, he died and I was present and alive. And then I met my now husband and I slipped into depression, anger again. So I'm saying the trauma was still saying,
Yeah.
I'm still here. I'm still here. You still have to deal with me.
Pay attention to me. I'm still living in your body.
I'm still in your body. Yeah, there was that little girl. She's in my body, stomping her feet, saying, you
Look
need
at
to
me.
hear me. I need my story needs to be told. And so, you know, now I don't live in a disassociated.
Not at all. And I'm, you know, for our listeners that maybe don't haven't heard your story before, if this is their first time, Jane, you are such a strong, relentless, powerful advocate for sibling sexual abuse. And I know that this is not what you envisioned your life's mission to be, or like where you
Not.
see at this stage, but you, I'd love to shift gears for right now for you to highlight the amazing things that you are doing. You have created a platform to raise awareness to help victims, survivors, and families. Can you speak about what you are doing to this end?
Yes, and this happened kind of by accident, in that I started writing my story. It took me 7 years to write the story. And then COVID happened. And I did what a lot of people did. I was online, kids were home, and I started taking some courses. And I took a course on how to pitch a media and how to get in the news. Because by this time I was hearing from parents, I was hearing from survivors, I was hearing from those who had caused harm or abuse. And I thought, okay, parents deserve to know that this is in their homes. They deserve to know, because parents would reach out to me and say, we had no idea this was a thing. And I thought, you deserve to know. And the child who causes harm or abuse deserves to know. They deserve to know that they could potentially hurt another person or destroy their lives. So I started pitching the media. The media did not want to hear from me. The emails went unopened, or, oh, that's an interesting topic. If we ever talk about it, we'll reach out. Silence. So I started getting a little pissy and I thought, fine. And through one of these courses, I had met a TEDx coach and I said to my husband, I said, I'd like to sit down with this guy. He gives a 15-minute free phone call. Husband's like, fine, do whatever. So I sat down with this TEDx coach and he said, well, I've never heard of sibling sexual abuse. It's a tough topic, but I think we could do something with it. And he said, so you're not a coach? I said, no. And he said, you're not selling anything? I said, no, I'm just trying to raise awareness. He said, okay. So I started working with a TEDx coach and we came up with an idea worth spreading. And I kept getting rejected by TEDx. So my TEDx coach almost gave me my money back. But we finally reached someone and they got on a phone call with us and they said, look, you know, we don't mean any disrespect, but we love your topic and we want our audience to be a little uncomfortable. Can you do that? And I said, yes, I can do that. So I finally landed my TEDx. And I was preparing, I was writing the TEDx, I was memorizing the TEDx. And during that period of time, a parent reached out to me and said, look, this happened in my home. And when it happened, I couldn't find any resources. So COVID happened. I've been home. I wrote a website called Sibling Sexual Trauma. Would you look over it as a survivor? I thought, yes, because this is needed. And I started looking through the site and I thought, oh my gosh, this is way too much information. I can't do this alone. So I reached out to another public survivor, Maria Sokolov. And I said, would you help me look at this? And she said, yes. Also, as an advocate, I hear from parents and parents are looking for support and I didn't have a place to put them. So I did find a Facebook group for parents of sibling sexual abuse and trauma. And I was in touch with the moderator of that group. So when this website came up, I reached out to that moderator and I said, would you like to be part of this? And she said, yes. And then in the meantime, I had another parent reach out to me. So we had three parents and two survivors, and we were going to look at this website together. And so we got on a Zoom call, five women, five different time zones. One is in the UK, and we shared our stories on Zoom and we cried because we'd all felt alone and none of us could find any resources. And that's how we formed our 501c3 Five Waves. And through Five Ways, we're raising international awareness. Researchers and collaborators and practitioners are reaching out to us, asking us for our lived experience voices, and we're supporting survivors. We have a Facebook group. Well, we send people to a survivor support group, but we actually facilitate the parent support group. So Yeah, it's amazing. We're raising awareness and we're building community of survivors, and more survivors are coming forward and sharing their stories.
You being so open and honest about your experiences and your stories is giving permission for people literally worldwide to be able to speak up and say, this happened to me, or this I think happens in my family and I need to investigate this. It is incredible the impact that you are having and the positive change that you are creating for people that have experienced this. And again, I want to highlight that it is much more common than people originally thought. This isn't like
Yes.
some very obscure thing. Like, this is happening in our neighborhoods. It's there whether we're going to talk about it or not. So let's talk about it, because can you speak about the importance of having a family be supportive and to take action when they find out something is happening?
Yes, I will. This is, I do tell parents this. If you have an instinct going on in your stomach, if you sense something might be going on or happening, listen to that instinct. You know, you may not have any proof, but listen to that instinct. And I also believe in teaching our children body safety and teaching an open door policy that our children can come to us and ask us anything. Now, if you have a teenager and you're just discovering this and your teenager's already slamming the door in your face, I'm not a parent expert, but I think the biggest thing is open communication. If you sense something, sit down and ask curious questions. There's some great organizations. Stop It Now has some great talking points, Consent Parenting, Tough Topics, Mom, Parenting Safe Children, Mama Bear Effect. There's lots of resources out there to talk to your younger children so that they can come to you with any questions in any situations. That's the start. But I think if we normalize the discussion around it, we're going to lessen the shame. And I think that if you have an adolescent, that adolescent deserves to be told, look, you're going to have questions. Your body's going through a lot of change. And you're going to hope that it's the parent that they come to, but maybe there's another safe adult that they can come to. Because today's day and age, not when I was growing up, but today's day and age, it's, when your children come across pornography, not if.
Yeah, correct.
And when they come across pornography, their body responds. And then they can go to a younger sibling or younger cousin and act out on that. So I think the biggest thing is open communication. And like you said, this is actually considered to be the most common form of sexual abuse in our homes. And the most searched page on our website is Where is the Line?
Yes.
We
Yes.
don't know. We
Yeah.
don't know.
I've heard you say before that because we don't know what the line is, that the line is truly the lived experience of the survivor. And if they have experienced harm, physical, psychological, mental, emotional, if they've experienced harm, that's the line.
That's my belief. I'm not an expert, but I know that the experts, and I say experts in quotes, even though I know they are doing the best they can with what they have as well, because again, we need more stories, we need more research. They're dealing with a handful of information. They used to say if a child is 3 years older, it's sexual abuse. Then I had a survivor start reaching out to me saying, "Look, my sibling is only a year and a half older than me. Is that not abuse? Or my sibling was younger than me, so does that not count?" And that really broke my heart, and I had to start kind of really evaluating, stop repeating what the experts were saying, and thought, well, how did you experience it?
So it's great for an expert with like an educational degree to be able to say, okay, 3 years, that's the magic number, that's abuse, but 2.5, no, you're good. There's
Yeah,
no
and
problem.
they need guidelines. I
They
get it. Like I
do.
said, we need more stories. Like I said, my memoir's out there. I know of four other memoirs that are out there, and I know four more that are coming. So when I started Googling, there were no memoirs. So that's where we're coming from. So we're getting there. We're going to get the researchers the stories that they need. We're going to get there. It's
And
a
you're doing
marathon.
it. You're doing it. And you, like you just said, and I wanted to talk about this too. You wrote a memoir and you published it, and the world has access to read in all of the detail that you put out there, your story. What was the experience like to put pen to paper and write your story?
Healing. That's the most important thing. It was healing. It turned out to be a gift for me. I was able to look back and say, okay, if this is never published, it was still a gift to me.
Yes.
And I highly recommend writing. I'm not saying you have to write a book. I'm not saying you have to publish, but even just journaling, even getting it out. But it is probably wise to have support because sometimes you'll get it out on the paper and you'll take a step back and you'll just, it's like going back to that moment. And, you know, sometimes I would step back and I thought, wow, I really went through that. But I highly recommend it.
It's a therapeutic thing to put it on paper. And also, I appreciate that you said that it's recommended to have support in this process because you are going to be revisiting some very traumatic pieces of your life. And it's really helpful to have support in doing that.
Yeah.
So, the title of your memoir is I Feel Real Guilty. Can you tell
Yes.
us why did you choose that for a title?
Yeah, I did get some pushback from some survivors on my title, and because I said, well, why do you feel guilty? But the title is actually selected from my 6-year-old self. I had written my mother a letter because I had gotten in trouble for kissing a boy on the playground. And I was in trouble and I needed her to sign some paperwork. And it was at that point that I wrote her a letter. I said, dear mother, I feel real guilty about something. And I went into this whole letter about how, you know, I'm going to leave boys alone. I want to be a good-minded girl. I don't want to be this bad girl. And it was my way of trying to tell her that in 6th grade, I was boy crazy. I had these sexual feelings that were too big for me. I was trying to tell her something had happened with my body that wasn't quite right, but I didn't have the words. So that's where that is. That's why the title is called I Feel Real Guilty. I don't deal with feelings of guilt as much anymore, but I still feel guilty. I still feel responsible for my sibling and don't want to hurt them. And I still feel responsible for keeping the family together, you know, other sibling, my mom. So not wanting to throw my family under the bus. So I don't know that I feel guilty anymore, but I have a sense of responsibility. So that's where the title came from. It's from the little girl's perspective.
And I think it's so important that you're honoring the little girl's perspective because it's her perspective that has been silenced and not given a platform to speak for so many years. So I think it's a beautiful thing that you chose the perspective and the voice and the words that that younger version of yourself would use. And for people that are looking for information and drawn to your book, if they've experienced it, they're going to resonate with the words that you used for your title because I'm guessing that they have those feelings wherever they are in the healing journey and process that those words have come up, or some semblance of that, of what you put out there for your title. Since you've published your book and your story is out there now, what has been the impact with your inner circle, your friends, your community, your family?
That has been, it's an interesting question because you need your friends and family to purchase your book, to read your book, to write the review, to get it. It needs its legs to get into the world. And then you start hearing from fans and family who actually read the book. And I just, like, a couple times my heart has just like, because one point, a friend, a male friend, his wife was going to read the book. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, has your wife had a chance to read the book? I'd love to hear her feedback. And he said, well, it's my fault. I'm reading it. So she hasn't had a chance to read it. And I thought, wait, you're reading it? So that's been kind of hard. But now it's in the world. It's been in the world, what, maybe 4 or 5 months. And I feel like it's not my story anymore. It's a chapter of my life. It's in the world. It's hopefully going to help someone else. So it's not so much about me anymore, but I still have to talk about it because I'm still trying to raise awareness. We're still trying to get, you know, to our survivors and our parents and those who have caused harm and abuse. So we're still trying to reach the people. We're still trying to make this mainstream. But overall, I think it's been very healing and enlightening for people, I hope.
I'm sure it is, and it's going to continue to be. So one important person that I wanted to ask about their response to your book is your brother.
I don't know if he knows it's out there.
Oh,
Yeah, so here's the thing is that when I was 21, he had pulled me aside and said, "I'm sorry for what I did to you when you were little." And I remember shutting down and thinking, "What did you do to me when I was little?" And then I remembered and I said to him, "It's okay. I participated." And I just put that box away. But in the back of my head, I had that apology and I could think, well, he knows it happened. He's not just going on with life as usual. He knows it happened. He's acknowledged it. And that's a gift, I think, that not everybody gets. So when I was about 45, 47, I started getting angry and depressed. I was really raging and I was really angry at him and blaming him for all of my problems. And at some point, I was able to land and I reached out to him and I said, "Look, I think that this story needs to be told. I don't think I was the only 6-year-old little girl. I don't think you were the only 12-year-old little boy. And I'm getting this nudge that I'm supposed to talk about this, even though this was not what I wanted to talk about. I didn't want this to be my thing, but it's my thing." And he was supportive. And so then I started asking him questions. I would say, "Look, I have this memory. Did that happen?" And he was really careful in the way he answered his questions to not trigger me and not give me more memories because he realized I had enough. He had enough. I had enough to work with. And he said, "I will support you in whatever way you need to be, whatever you need to heal." But it's not like he's out there saying it was me, it was me. So he understands why I'm advocating. He knows that I gave the TEDx. I don't know if he's ever watched the TEDx. He knows that I was in People magazine. Probably did never read that. He knows that I was working on a book. I don't know if he knows that the book is out there in the world. And I don't really need him to read it because as he said, we experienced the trauma differently. And there's some level from him he doesn't really want to know. And that's okay. That's his path. I think that I have been told that it's not a revenge memoir from another reader's perspective, because I'm so close to it, it's hard for me to really understand how a perspective might be taken. But people have told me, it's not a revenge memoir. And it's also not a memoir just about sibling sexual abuse, because we've got the stripping, we've got the early death. It's not all sad. But it's also not all rainbows and unicorns. But the ending is hopeful. So he probably will never read it, and that's okay.
And that's okay. And that's okay. And it's so interesting that he approached you in your 20s and, acknowledged what had happened and apologized and what your response was, because you were still in that phase of your healing journey where you were squashing it and not talking about it. You just
Yeah.
continued to be like, oh, it's fine. It's all good.
Yeah. It's
I
fine.
participated. It's great. Yeah. And then meanwhile, like 20 plus years later, you're like having these intense emotions and raging and angry. And then it's because the trauma is still in you, it needed to come out. As you
Yeah.
said earlier, the little girl version of you needed to be seen and heard and validated, and so that, and I love that that's exactly what you're doing right now.
Yeah, and he was actually surprised to hear from me. He kind of said, "Well, I thought this was done. I apologized. I thought it was
Yeah,
done."
right.
So it's just interesting how that little girl wasn't going to go away.
Yeah, no, she's stubborn.
She's very stubborn.
So, question I have for you. Have you forgiven your brother?
I have. And that, again, was not overnight. It was not linear. When I was very raging and depressed, my mom put a lot of pressure on me to forgive him. She said, "You need to forgive, you need to forgive, you need to forgive." And I said, "I don't need to do anything." And this, again, I think a lot of the things that I've gone through, I say happened by accident because it wasn't planned. I only touch on this a little bit, but when I was, again, 45, 47, I was married to my now husband, two children, minding my own business. And I went for a massage and I was sexually assaulted on the massage table. And I froze. I didn't run out of there screaming. I didn't jump off the table. I froze. But through that, again, didn't happen overnight. I understood, wait a second, A grown woman, I froze. I didn't understand what was happening. My body responded, which created a tremendous amount of shame. And I thought, well, how is that 6-year-old little girl supposed to know what to do if this grown woman can't do anything about it or didn't do anything about it? It was at that moment or that period of time that I forgave that 6-year-old little girl for enjoying the touch, for not telling. So that's where my forgiveness journey started, is I forgave that 6-year-old little girl first. And then I was able to incorporate forgiveness in my life and forgive my sibling.
And that is incredible in and of itself, because when you choose to forgive somebody, in my opinion, and I don't know if this rings true for you, it's not so much for the other person as it is for yourself, and that it frees you, and it frees you from being a victim, or it frees you from having. From letting that person or that memory or that experience have control over your life for moving forward.
Yes. And I think that forgiveness can look like very different things to very different individuals. I don't say you have to. I think that you can, that I think there's a book called Des by Desmond Tutu about forgiveness, and I think that really helped me understand that it doesn't, it can be very different for each person. For me, it started by forgiving that 6-year-old little girl, and then it flowed over to my sibling. And I think that it's, I'm not saying you have to forgive in order to heal, but that was my path for sure. And I will say another aspect of my forgiveness journey was that I heard from one of his children, because I'd taken his whole family and put them in a box. They were all dead to me. And I heard from one of his children, and I was annoyed. And then I wrote back to this child, and this child responded back, she's, thank you for responding, because I thought you hated me. Something along those lines. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is impacting the next generation. They had nothing to do with this. This has to stop now. So there was all those things. So like I said, it wasn't from point A to point B to point C. It was very zigzaggy and lots of pitfalls, but that was another part of the healing process too.
And then, one of the final questions I want to ask for you, Jane, is that, you've done so much in your healing process and in your journey, and now with your advocacy and making this a part of your life's mission. I'm curious for you, what does the next chapter of your life hold? And whether it's in relation to your advocacy or something completely different, what do you see coming for you next?
Well, I have two juniors in high school, and in the next year and a half, I anticipate they're leaving. So those are questions I've been asking myself. What does my life look like being not, because I've been a stay-at-home mom for 17 years. I love being a mom. What is my life looking like next? And I just kind of go through the next open door. So I think what's happening next, in all honesty, is that Five Waves is partnering with Thriving Survivors out of Scotland, and we will be putting on our first SSA conference in the United States in 2026. So that's going to keep me very busy. Five Waves, we're a 501c3. We're figuring out how to apply for grants. We're figuring out how to add more people to the team. I would love to pass on, I can't wait for the next survivor to give another TEDx. More memoirs. So I think in my life right now, advocacy is here to stay, because when I help someone else, it helps me heal. So right now, I think the next thing is the conference. That'll keep me busy for a while. And after that, I'll go through the next open door, whatever that might look like.
I love that. Just waiting for the next open door, and you are going to continue to touch so many lives through your advocacy and giving people permission to speak about this topic. And again, I just want to thank you so much for your time here today and for your openness and just being real and not trying to sugarcoat or make things sound a certain kind of way. You're just being real and you're putting it out there. And that in and of itself is a huge gift to give others permission to do exactly the same thing and start their own healing process.
And thank you for using your platform for a tough topic.
Wow, what an incredibly powerful and necessary conversation. I want to thank Jane for her bravery, her advocacy, and her willingness to share her story. Her work is helping so many survivors feel seen, heard, and supported. If today's conversation resonated with you, please know that you are not alone. Healing from trauma, especially something as complex as sibling sexual abuse, takes time, self-compassion, and support. And if you are on a journey to rediscover yourself after trauma, I want you to know that I am here to help. Through my coaching, I support women who feel stuck, disconnected, or weighed down by past experiences. Together, we can help you break free from old patterns, reconnect with your true self, and step into a life that feels aligned, fulfilling, and truly yours. If you are ready to take that next step, I would love to connect. Visit my website, lauraflowersllc.com, to book a free discovery call and learn more about how we can work together. If you found value in this episode, please consider sharing it with someone who needs to hear it. Let's continue breaking the silence and creating space for healing. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And thank you for doing the work to rediscover you. I'll see you next time.